on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. If you've listened to the show for a while, you've probably heard parts or all of General Dwight Eisenhower's famous D-Day address at one point or another.
You are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you.
That's a little bit of what everybody heard on June 6, 1944, but a couple of weeks earlier, Eisenhower was on the battleship Texas in Belfast. You heard our guest Willis Shepherd describe the speech that Eisenhower gave and what it meant to him. And one of the things I have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page is a transcript of that speech aboard the USS Texas on May 19th, 1944. Before we get back to Mr. Shepherd's memories, let me read that speech to you. And imagine yourself as Mr. Shepherd or one of those other sailors aboard this historic battleship. The general begins, "No man could be more honored than I in the opportunity to come out here this morning and on this ship, which by coincidence is named after the state of my birth, to welcome here into the great Allied team that has been operating in the European theater for the past 18 months, the officers and men of the ships that have come to bear their part in the beginning of the real attack on Axis Europe. I assure you that standing here this morning, there is not only the pride of an American and a great institution, one of which we are so proud at home, but I think I have the feeling that here in these mighty ships and in their crews, there is with me once and for all in this thing the might and tradition of the United States Navy, coupled up with similar forces of His Majesty's Navy, and that there is a support that has come to me that makes me feel better than I have in the 18 long months. I am truly thrilled." The textbooks that most of your senior officers have followed as they have gone through the services say that the high commander should go down and inspect the troops in order to inspire them and in order to impress his personality upon them. In my case, I must be a throwback or monkey or something is wrong because I always carry back to my own desk a thrill and inspiration that comes only when I get to see the fighting men. Because this is one thing I would like all of you to remember. There are limitations in war upon what the high command can do. Admiral Kirk has given me some credit for getting these United States ships here. Well, I certainly argued and cursed enough about it, but after all, that is just getting them over. The high command can get you the supplies, can make sure of your preparations, it can make sure that your air coverage is present, because in the next battle we are going into, we are going in with the greatest air coverage that has ever accompanied you and your forces in history. They provide for taking care of you when wounded. They see that you are disposed properly, that your guns are turned on the right targets, but my God, men, you do the fighting. No general or any other person in high capacity really fires the shots that knocks out the enemy batteries and sinks the ships. You are the people who do it. You are the man handling the guns and turrets, the man handling the firing of the weapons, torpedoes, Bofors, everything. You are the men who are winning the war. You have come to do it, and all we can do is see that everything is made ready. And then you, with your American courage, your American indomitable will to win, have got to be at your best. Knock that Hitler out of the war. Yours is the job, and you are the men that the United States is going to be proud of. God bless you all, and good luck go with every one of you. Let me tell you, the feeling that you are in there pitching with us is a great one for me as I contemplate the great day. Those are the words, the complete remarks of General Dwight Eisenhower to Willis Shepherd and 1,800 other sailors aboard the USS Texas before that Normandy invasion. We heard a little bit of Mr. Shepherd's D-Day memories, a few of the things he saw from aboard the Texas at Omaha Beach, and we heard him say he lost his hearing because of those giant 14-inch guns firing up above him. But Mr. Shepherd, you said you were on a 5-inch gun, and just to educate everybody here, how many men does it take to man one of those 5-inch guns on the deck of this battleship?
There was six guys. There was a trainer and a pointer, and then we had muzzle loaders and ammunition passers, and probably five or six guys.
And did you have to know all of those roles, or what did you do specifically?
I was a trainer on a five-inch gun. That's all taken care of by one system of not a radar, but sort of like radar. And you just train the gun to match their equipment.
So you're looking at a mechanism that is talking about range and left, right, up and down, and getting into the right spot.
Right.
And did you have much of an understanding of what the result of those projectiles was, what kind of damage you guys were doing, or if you were hitting the right spot?
Well, yeah, they announced over the speaker system that whenever they tore up gun emplacements or things like that. We went into Cherbourg after this was 3 or 4 days after the landing. We were about 3 miles out, and they started shooting, firing 11.6 shells at us, and we had two direct hits and 65 near misses. And one shell came in and hit the top of the conning tower, and of course the bridge is right above that, and it just tore the bridge up, and we were out of control there for a little while, and then we had to go to England then and get repairs and get more supplies and stuff. So then we came back, or we left there, and after that we got fixed up, and then we left there and went back down to southern France and did a little shooting, firing down there.
And forgive me for bouncing around a little bit here, but I'm sure a lot of people have asked you, when they hear where you were on June 6, 1944, they probably want to know about it. And so much has been said and written about that day, the longest day. Did it feel like the longest day to you? Did it seem like it was never going to end?
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, I felt sorry for the landing troops. They really took a beating when they went in there. Of course, it was the current was bad, and there was waves, and they ended up sinking about 3 or 4, or maybe it was more than that, old Liberty ships for a breakwater. They just sunk the ships and for a breakwater so they could get supplies and stuff and men in there. So it worked out. They was well organized.
And I know it's not easy to think about this, but what are the things that you saw that you can still see in your mind today that very few people have ever seen? Can you kind of paint that picture for when you had time to look out to your left, to your right, and straight ahead, what you actually saw?
Well, the landing crafts were going in there with the men. I could see from where we were, guys Germans were just knocking them off and killing them, a lot of guys, before they even hit the beach. But after we started knocking out some of those gun emplacements, why, it got a lot better then. And they were landing, coming in there with probably no problem after that.
And of course, 30 years ago, President Reagan gave that speech over there and so famously drew attention to one little aspect of it, those Rangers that were scaling the cliffs at Point Du Hoc there. Did you see where that was or see any of that going on?
Only pictures of it, yeah. I would have liked to have gone over there. Matter of fact, I'd still like to go over there and see what it's like today. I kind of wonder if they ever raised those ships or whatever they did with those old Liberty ships.
Yes, they called them block ships, and it was a long, secretly planned project to create that breakwater. They put floating concrete structures above them, and you can still see remnants of that artificial harbor if you visit Normandy today. I haven't had that privilege of visiting Normandy, but those who have often talk about the cemeteries, very moving and emotional places. And it makes me wonder, when did it hit you, the magnitude of it all, the number of lives lost there, and did you lose any off your ship?
Yeah, there was several men killed on the bridge when that shell hit the conning tower. The other shell that we got hit with came through the side in an officer's room and didn't explode, but we were lucky there.
This is a weird question, I guess. Because you still have a war to fight and you're going on to these other spots, and I want to talk about some of the other things you experienced. But was there a point during or after the war where you realized, you know, that day, June 6th, was a gigantic day in world history, and the world changed a lot in that one day that you were a part of?
Yeah, I also realized all these islands in the Pacific that were taken over from the Japanese were just as important as Normandy, but Normandy was just a bigger project than any one of the islands. We went to the Pacific after Normandy, and went through the canal and went to Iwo Jima invasion and Okinawa invasion. And we were in the Philippines when the war ended, when the Japanese surrendered. That was a hallelujah day.
I bet, and I want to hear about it. That must have been an adventure, though, for you, to go from the Atlantic through this Panama Canal and back to the other side. I mean, talk about seeing both ends of something and both ends of the spectrum. What do you remember about that journey?
Our worst part of the Pacific was the suicide planes. We didn't get hit with any of them, but we shot down some of them at very close range to the ship.
Was that at Okinawa?
Well, at Okinawa and Iwo Jima both.
The Iwo Jima came first before Okinawa. What was the duty of your ship? Were you guys just off the shore shelling?
Yeah, we shelled Iwo Jima probably 2 days before they landed troops there. It was a small island, but we poured a lot of lead in there, but it kind of softened up the troops a little bit. But they hung tight because they lost a lot of men there in Iwo Jima.
Yeah, and of course, someone hears Iwo Jima, they think of that maybe the most famous photograph of all of World War II, of the flag going up atop Mount Suribachi. And I've talked to a lot of sailors who maybe never even set foot on Iwo Jima, but said they saw that flag flying from their ship. Is that something you experienced?
I saw that flag go up. I just happened to be looking at Mount Suribachi when they put that flag up.
Did it mean something to you?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
So when you see that photo today, or you see, you know, I know you went back to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Kern County and visited the Marine Corps Memorial, which is a larger-than-life 3D version of that moment. When you see any kind of representation of those guys hoisting that flag, what does it mean to you?
Pretty impressive. I felt like I was right there.
And you mentioned the kamikazes. Was that a helpless feeling when those are coming your way, I mean, to not know if one's going to hit you guys or not?
Well, they were very experienced pilots. They were always trying to attack a troop ship or a larger ship like a cruiser or battleship. They flew real low to the water, and of course there'd be a lot of other ships in the area, and they knew that certain ships couldn't fire at them because they'd liable to hit another ship. So, and they flip the wings back and forth, up and down. And I saw a destroyer. I don't remember the name of it, but I saw a destroyer that shot down 17 suicide planes, and the 18th one hit it, and it just leveled it. It was hardly anything above the water.
What's the closest one came to hitting the Texas?
Oh, I'd say probably 150 yards, maybe 300 yards.
And were you ever in a position of trying to shoot one down?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Our 40 millimeters and 20 millimeters were our prime guns for the suicide planes.
So you actually hopped on one of those and tried to shoot one down?
Well, I was on the 5-inch, so we shot at them, but the 40s and the 20s were really the prime guns for suicide planes. We were anchored in a little island called Ulysses. We were only there about a day or two. That was before Iwo Jima, and there was a carrier Randolph was probably a half a mile in front of us. We were up on the forecastle going to go watch a movie, and the suicide plane come in there and hit it. And I saw that ship get hit twice when it was anchored. And another time it was in the Philippines. It was a P-38 doing some control diving and one thing and another, and he must have blacked out because he went right into the flight deck of that Randolph and it was anchored.
When you see that happen, whether it's that little destroyer or that giant carrier, and you see things like that happen to other ships, is there something that says, hey, that might happen to my ship, that might happen to me?
Sure do. You give a lot of thought about it.
And where does it take you? Did you believe that you would survive, that you would get through that?
Oh, I don't know. I felt pretty secure. All our guns and everything were pretty protective, you know. We could just about take care of ourselves. Still, you never know. Those suicides sneak in on you, and anything could happen, you know.
Absolutely. And there was more that happened. We're going to hear about it when we come back. And I'll also ask Mr. Shepherd about his experience with Honor Flight Kern County. Wherever you're listening today, there's an Honor Flight organization ready to fly the World War II veteran in your life free of charge to see the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. If you're like Mr. Shepard there in the Bakersfield area, Honor Flight Kern County's next trip is almost here. If you want to help send veterans off from the Bakersfield Airport, they're going to be leaving early in the morning on Thursday, August 21st, and you can welcome them home Saturday night, August 23rd. I have a link to that information at hometownheroesradio.com. The rest of Willis Shepard's story when we come back, and I'm also going to read you something written by someone 80 years younger than Mr. Shepard. I don't think you want to miss it. The rest of Hometown Heroes right after this.